I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, Attorney General Eric Holder addressed a civil rights group meeting that included the parents of Florida shooting victim Trayvon Martin and said the Justice Department will take appropriate action if its investigation finds evidence that a federal criminal civil rights crime has been committed. And Florida's special prosecutor said she will make an announcement about the state investigation by Friday. The lawyers for the shooter, George Zimmerman, say they're no longer representing him because they haven't heard from him since Sunday. They say he's in hiding far from Florida, suffering from stress, and that against their advice, he contacted the special prosecutor, Angela Corey, and Sean Hannity of Fox News. There's a lot going on. Mark Caputo is a reporter for the Miami Herald. He joins us. And Mark, let's check in. First of all, what do you make of this announcement by George Zimmerman's attorneys that they're not representing him?
I make it that we're in Florida. You know, welcome to Florida. This is just one of the many weird twists and turns that seem to happen in cases of weird twists and turns that wind up emanating out of the state.
Well,
you know, we had Casey Anthony a little while ago, and now this.
Well, in fact, the attorneys mentioned Casey Anthony in a kind of a funny way yesterday. But I'm just wondering, you know, is there a feeling there in the Florida area, maybe even on the part of Zimmerman's critics, people who think he shouldn't have been armed as a neighborhood watchman and should have stayed in his car, that he's maybe bearing the brunt of scrutiny that should be directed more towards Florida law? We know there have been so many other cases similar to this one under the Hold Your Ground law.
Yeah, so, well, the Stand Your Ground law, that's true. Understand that a lot of the scrutiny being paid to the Stand Your Ground law is in part because it's a gun law. Now, yes, this child was shot, probably by George Zimmerman, but
no, he's definitely by George Zimmerman.
Yeah, he definitely. Yeah. Well, yeah, heck, I don't want to get sued, but I imagine there's a long line of people in front of me. But you know, other people who have pleaded protections under Stand Your Ground have still been arrested. There's no evidence that says because the Stand Your Ground law exists, Zimmerman got out of his car, followed the kid, and then shot him. Right now, what the attention of Stand Your Ground, rightfully so, was whether or not the police and prosecutors at the time acted rightfully by declining to arrest him. And we'll have an answer to that perhaps today, tomorrow, or by Friday from the special prosecutor.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is there some sympathy towards Zimmerman because there's been so much focus on him, even though, as we said, there are critics of what he did. His attorneys say he's unable to see a psychologist because he could be spotted. There's a bounty out for his arrest issued by the new Black Panther Party. You know, is there a sense that, well, wait a second, this issue may be bigger than this one man?
Well, I had written about this a little while ago now. There is a partisan political divide that you're seeing forming here, and, you know, that's a convenient way to start talking about Sean Hannity. But you're finding kind of a partisan division. Republicans seem more inclined to feel sympathy for and to criticize and question Trayvon, and you seem to see Democrats and liberals more who criticize Zimmerman and question his actions and are holding Trayvon up to be a victim. Don't get me wrong, he is a victim. The kid was shot, and I imagine, though I don't know, that if George Zimmerman can do this all over again, he wouldn't have gotten out of that car. He wouldn't have shot that kid.
Well, given what you said, though, that this is becoming politicized, and I'm going to rush to say that we heard early on many of the Republican presidential candidates talking about it as a tragedy, and you know, it's not the lines aren't as clear as you're saying, but there is a schism growing and growing, and you're wondering in that case if we don't know what the state prosecutor is going to say, but if he is arrested, George Zimmerman, and put on trial, is that going to be possible in Florida?
Oh, yeah, it's going to be possible, but I think almost anywhere you go, if you just look at the facts as we know them now those facts will change, convicting George Zimmerman is going to be almost impossible, in my opinion, because you had the prosecutors at the time declining to arrest him. You had the police at the time who didn't arrest him. You can almost present a defense against a prosecution by using the actions of the arm of prosecution of the government in place at the time when the incident occurred. There are no real eyewitnesses to what happened. I think it's going to be very difficult for prosecutors, if they charge him, to get a conviction beyond all reasonable doubt that Zimmerman did this. Now, that is murdered or really shot him recklessly. I don't know. We'll have to see what charges, if any, the prosecutor comes up with. But it's going to be a tough case to prosecute.
Well, as you said, that's where we are poised right now. We're going to have to wait to see what both the state prosecutor and the federal investigation come up with. Mark Caputo with the Miami Herald, thanks for, you know, sort of bringing us up to date.
Thanks.
Question, did Mitt Romney display a tin ear in responding to Rick Santorum's emotional exit, at least for now, from presidential politics? Here's Romney's response yesterday.
This has been a good day for me.
So let's get the lay of the political land as now just three wagons hitch up to hit the trail to the Republican presidential nomination. Mike Allen is chief White House correspondent for Politico. His new e-book, co-authored with Evan Thomas, is called Inside the Circuits. It's a look at the campaign so far. And he joins us for a look at how this wagon train moves forward with Newt Gingrich and Ron Paul still on board. Mike, what do you think? Did that Romney comment strike you as tone deaf, especially with Rick Santorum's daughter so ill?
Well, Robin, in a moment like that, a politician, a leader would normally say, this is a great day for America or a great day for the Republican Party. I think he was doing what politicians rarely do. He was saying what he actually thought. He was saying his honest thought. But you're right. It wasn't what was needed at the moment. And this has been a struggle for the Romney campaign. As Evan Thomas and I dug behind the scenes of the campaign for this ebook, we found that people were inside the campaign were really conflicted about how much to let the real Romney out there. They can't agree of whether he's too scripted or not scripted enough. So family members want us to see more of him. And Robin, that's why starting this week, we're going to see a ton of Romney family photos, videos. You've seen the video that's out there of Ann Romney narrating family snapshots, old family movies. The effort is to get them to show us the Romney that they say they see.
Well, and you know, so that goes to my what was going to be my question: which Romney? It reminds us of a Boston Globe columnist, Brian McGorry, had a column a while back, and I've always kept it because it was about the two sides of Mitt. Of course, he was the former governor here, and McGorry writes how, on the one hand, he could be so thoughtful, on the other, so thoughtless. And again, that comment that we heard, you know, great day for me, as, you know, Rick Santorum's practically in tears. And Brian McGorry writes about an anecdote when Mitt Romney was campaigning in an Italian bakery. Rudy Giuliani's with him. A blue-collar worker yells out, Mitt, let me buy a cannoli. And Brian is thinking, oh, this is great. Mitt Romney was going to look like a man of the people. Instead, Mitt Romney nervously says, no, thanks. And it's left to Rudy Giuliani to turn to the man and yell out, let me buy you the cannoli. And it's Giuliani who eats the cannolis with people and gets all the pictures in the paper. You know, that seems to be what, you know, yes, we may be seeing more of Mitt Romney. Is his campaign nervous about that?
Well, they are. And, of course, what they'll say is there's a difference between campaigning and governing. And I love your story because when Rudy Giuliani turns out to be the warm and cuddly and PR-minded one, that's saying something. But that's the hurdle of our system, that what it takes to get elected is not necessarily take what it takes to govern. And they come in different flavors. President Clinton was fantastic with small groups. President Obama, very brilliant with large groups. Mitt Romney's finding his way, and he has a chance now. In these few weeks, now that he's the real nominee, what people who've run these campaigns on both sides tell me is that you have a chance that, Robin, you and I rarely have, and that is a second chance to make a first impression. So there are a lot of people who've not been tuned in to the race, or not your listeners, not our readers, but a big part of the middle of America, the part of America that decides elections, is just going to be tuning in. And so this is a very crucial week for Romney, and that's why you see President Obama totally jamming his foot on the gas, taking the risk of being criticized for being too harsh, too political, because they want to seize this moment to define Mitt Romney when more people are listening.
Well, this is funny you mention this, because we're thinking another thing that has happened just in the last 2 days is that for television stations in Pennsylvania are disappointed that Rick Santorum has pulled out, because the Romney campaign had millions of dollars worth of this negative carpet bombing ad setup. They're pulling those ads, which is pulling that money out of Pennsylvania. But it's also, you know, meaning that the Romney campaign does not have to go negative on Rick Santorum. And it reminds us, a lot of people made fun of Eric Fernstrom, Romney's top aide, for saying that campaigns are like an Etch-a-Sketch, you can just reset. Wasn't he right, in a way?
Well, of course. A lot of times people say they get criticized for are right. And, of course, what he was referring to was sort of resetting the dynamics of the campaign, not saying that his guy was going to be saying all new things. But hold on, Mike.
Isn't he going to? I mean, you know, people were worried that Mitt Romney had tacked too far to the right in order to match Rick Santorum, and Rick Santorum pulling him there, saying you're not conservative enough. The concern was, could Mitt Romney tack back to get independents and the female voters he's lost? Isn't he going to do that now?
Well, it's a little bit twas ever thus. As you know, Robin, in primaries, people always are in a slightly different place because he is so sensitive to the damage that, rightfully so, will come to him from the flip-flop issue. He's going to avoid flip-flopping more. It's why he wound up embracing his health care plan when some people very close to him, very high up, advised him to say that it was a mistake. But they've just decided, like, they can't spill the blood that it would take to reverse themselves intentionally on something else. So, of course, we're going to find a shifting of priorities, but that's different than outright reversals. But, Robin, this likability issue is the deepest hole that Romney is in. In that Washington Post ABC poll that came out yesterday, 38-point cap in the question, regardless of who you support, who do you find friendlier and more likable? That's a really deep hole, and he has to worry about Hispanics. He has to worry about women. And that's ironic, by the way, because as a lot of your listeners know, it was Mitt Romney who did better with women during these primaries. It was Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum who had the high male vote. And we saw Mitt Romney's events out in Iowa, New Hampshire, his early state events, very much geared toward women. But now going against Barack Obama, it's a totally different landscape. And he's the one that's on the defensive on that issue.
Mike Allen, chief White House correspondent for Politico. Romney's aides have been calling that the likability meme. You know, it's almost like a viral thing that even if you don't know it, you have heard that Mitt Romney has a likability problem. So it's sort of like something that catches on. We're up against a break and we're going to have you back after the break. But just real quick, how does Mitt Romney do what your colleague Jonathan Martin says he has to do, which is now get Rick Santorum on his side? How does that happen?
Well, Rick Santorum will do it because it's in his interest, and Rick Santorum wants a future in the party. And one thing that Evan Thomas and I discovered when we were digging behind the scenes of the campaigns for this ebook, Inside the Circus, was that the Romney campaign of 2012 goes all the way back, not to the general election of 2008, but to when he got out of the race then, he started helping John McCain right away. It was part of a very specific plan to make him viable to run again. Rick Santorum also wants a future in the party, whether it's 2016 or books or speeches, and so eventually he'll get on the train.
We're checking in with Mike Allen, chief White House correspondent for Politico. His new ebook, by the way, written with Evan Thomas, it's sort of a quickie read, sort of like tweets from the campaign trail. It's the story of the past year or so of the presidential campaign called Inside the Circus. And Mike, one of the things you write is that the story so far of campaign 2012 is Mitt Romney's perpetual vulnerability as a front runner, a vulnerability so profound that even a novice national figure like Rick Perry could spook him. So what happens now that Mitt Romney is, I mean, you know, people are saying he's the nominee, even though you've got Newt Gingrich and Ron Paul still on, as we said, this wagon train. What happens to that vulnerability now?
Well, Robin, he starts a little behind the president, but this is a 50-50 nation. These elections are decided sort of between the 40-yard lines. So I think that this race is going to be close. You talk to people on both sides, neither side thinks that we could be in a 96 type situation where President Clinton got that big lead on Bob Dole and never caught up. In Barack Obama's landslide of 2008, he got close to 53% of the vote. You talk to his people in Chicago, as Evan Thomas and I did for this book, they'll tell you that his ceiling is slightly lower this time, 52.5. Well, Robin, you know that in this country, the difference between 52.5 and 49 could be a few weeks. So the next few weeks are going to be very critical. People are going to get a sense of who these candidates are. And almost every time, going back, I think, at least to Jimmy Carter, in a presidential election, and this isn't always true in primaries, but in a general election, the more obviously likable person usually wins. And so that's why we're going to see Mitt Romney out going across the country doing a sort of this is your life, showing his life experiences, showing him in Salt Lake where he helped the Olympics, showing him Massachusetts where he helped people in his church, and talking about his mission work. And so this is a chance for his team to portray him in the way that they see him. For this ebook, Inside the Circus, Evan Thomas and I talked to Tag Romney, his oldest son, who talked about his father as Mr. Fix-It, coming over to the house with his pickup truck, trying to do yard work, trying to fix the water heater. And they're going to be trying to portray him as a Mr. Fix-It for the country. They know that if the race is about them, they're not going to do well. They'll probably lose. The race needs to be about Barack Obama. If Mitt Romney's being nickled and dimed about his dog and about his Swiss bank account, there's no way that that's going to have a happy ending for his campaign. So what they're doing now is looking for a big issue, a big way to confront this president. They haven't exactly found their footing on that. So what they're starting with is, here's our guy, another look at Mitt Romney, who was under the radar for so long, as your listeners know. And as a result of that, he was so rusty when he came out and did the Bret Baier interview.
Because there were so many other front runners. Yeah. Yeah, so many other front runners on the Republican side.
Exactly.
Right. Well, you write, though, that the Mitt Romney team, the campaign team, loves to go negative. You say it's not just put a nail in the coffin. It's some insider told you, dig up the casket, haul out the body, put some more bullets in it. You know, is that going to be something they can reverse?
Well, no, they're not going to try and reverse it. It works for them.
The campaign does that, but Mitt Romney, the person on the trail, is presented as the nice guy.
Well, the campaigns run on more than one track, as you know. And what this campaign found is that when they applied the Colin Powell military doctrine, overwhelming force, when they applied it in primaries, they won. That includes both ad spending by them and their super PAC. That includes hauling out the negative material on the other guy. And they've been loaded for bear from the beginning. One of the surprising discoveries that Evan Thomas and I had when we started interviewing them was that they didn't see Rick Santorum coming either. Mm-hmm. We didn't. We didn't cover him as a potential frontrunner, a potential nominee. But they were having a meeting at headquarters there on Commercial Street in the North End, and somebody asked for the Santorum book, the Santorum Oppo. And there wasn't one because they'd been focused on the other candidates. Similarly, they let Newt Gingrich up off the mat after New Hampshire, where Mitt Romney did very well. They go down to South Carolina. Newt Gingrich cleans their clocks after Florida when Mitt Romney had his big win there. I asked one of his aides, so now can you let up a little bit on Newt Gingrich? And they said, no, he's been dead before. So that's how this team thinks. They play rough, they play tough, and that's part of the president's message with these very caustic speeches is, hey, we're going to play tough, too.
Mike, we got about a minute left. What are you going to think we're going to see? We're going to have you back to talk about President Obama's campaign as it gets underway. He made a stab the other day at making fun of Mitt Romney's speech, the word marvelous. Some of our analysts said doesn't wear well on a president. What do you think we're going to be seeing there? Just about a minute here.
Yeah, what we're going to see is the president being tough on Romney, not being afraid to be seen as political, but also telling the story of his accomplishments. I think it was Joe Biden that coined what could be the title of this whole campaign, which is GM is alive and Osama bin Laden is dead. I think that we're going to hear that a lot. At the same time, we have the president building this amazing machine, which is able to connect with, turn out, not just Obama voters, people who supported Obama in the past, but they're making very sophisticated use of of social media to go out and find people that, based on demographics and geography, they think should be Obama voters. So finding people that they can go out and not just communicate with, but also register them, then get them to volunteer, then persuade them, then get them to turn out on November 6th, which is 209 days from now.
Okay. And by the way, President Barack Obama, out for the second day today, calling for the so-called Buffett rule, raising taxes on people making over a million. That seems to be, that'll be part of the debate going forward. Mike Allen, Chief White House Correspondent for Politico, thanks so much, as always.
Robin, it was fun. Love your audience.
In Afghanistan this week, nearly 24 people have been killed in suicide bombings carried out by the Taliban. More than 100 NATO troops have died in fighting there this year. So there's a drumbeat for the U.S. to speed up its withdrawal of combat troops by 2014. The fragile relationship between the U.S. and the Afghan government has also been damaged by those incidents, including the burning of Korans by U.S. soldiers and the massacre of 17 Afghans, allegedly by a U.S. Army sergeant in Kandahar. The setbacks may be hurting the U.S. effort to win hearts and minds in Afghanistan, but as the BBC's Bilal Sarwari reports, there are parts of the country where there are hopes for a future without the Taliban.
I'm walking inside the Karabakh Bazaar. Karabakh is a district which lies an hour away from Kabul city. 10 years ago, there used to be only 100 shops. Today, there are over 700 shops. Right in front of me is a shop that sells tea, cooking oil. Onto my right-hand side, there's a shop that sells sandals. I could see soap. This little town outside of Kabul has really benefited in the last 10 years since the Taliban were toppled from power. Yarmal is the owner of the grocery store. He says a lot has changed since the fall of the Taliban. Business was thin. Shopkeepers and customers lived in fear. The Taliban used to beat them up for no reason. They would ask them if they knew how to say their prayers in the correct Islamic way. I'm standing inside Harun Mir's garden. A political analyst and a farmer here in the Somali Plain. There are apple and apricot trees. There's a grapevine. This fertile area in the Somali Plain is known for its grapes, mulberries, and vegetables. The economy around Somali is heavily dependent on these products.
We sell it at a price that even it does not cover the cost. Before the start of conflict in Afghanistan, our products were mainly for the Indian market. And now since the Pakistanis are not collaborating, they're not allowing transit of Afghan goods and products to India, then we have no access to that big market.
What are the hopes and fears of Harun Mir as Afghanistan gets closer to 2014?
I hope that we will have a smooth transition, not only a security transition, but also a political transition in 2014. And hopefully by 2024, the old generation, those who have been involved in internal conflict in Afghanistan, would be out of the scene and the new generation will emerge at the leadership position. And my fear is that by 2014, we will not be able to manage the situation, and we fall back into chaos. The international community would leave and abandon us. And what I have done personally during the past 6 years in building this farm, we will lose everything once again. And that is the nightmare, not only for me, but for most villagers.
Although the market is now busy and thriving since foreign forces arrived in Afghanistan, the shopkeeper, Yarmal, does not want them to stay.
If they leave, then we will be happy. Afghanistan's army has reached nearly 200,000. Maybe our army will get bigger. The Taliban can't beat us. We can look after ourselves. They have to leave. Muslims don't want people who insult the Quran or our women.
Events involving U.S. soldiers in the last few weeks, Quran burnings, the massacre in Kandahar, have certainly made the battle for hearts and minds difficult and have increased anti-Americanism. But Afghans living in places like Karabakh, which have flourished since the invasion, are hoping that the 2014 transition will be peaceful and productive, and that the Taliban will be kept away.
That report from the BBC's Bilal Sarwari in Afghanistan. We recently reported on troubles at the Bozeman, Montana-based Central Asia Institute, the charity founded by Three Cups of Tea author Greg Mortensen to build schools in Afghanistan and Pakistan. After a year-long investigation, the Montana Attorney General ordered Mortensen to step down as a voting member of the board and CAI to hire an independent consultant to help reorganize. Mortensen was also ordered to pay back $1 million in misspent funds. By the way, the head of the American Institute of Philanthropy, Daniel Borichoff, says financial problems like those that were found at CAI are common in charities. He told the Great Falls Tribune, "It's a Wild West, and not just in Montana. Donors beware." But CAI says it's already become more transparent. And the Montana AG also said that despite financial problems, the mission of the Central Asia Institute makes it worth saving. And in our earlier report, I mentioned a fundraising letter I'd received from the group that I interpreted as CAI distancing itself from Greg Mortensen. Not true, as we're about to hear. He's still on the payroll, still an inspiration. Ann Beiersdorfer is acting director of the Central Asia Institute. She's long been with the group and is a family friend. Ann, how's everyone doing there?
We are all doing well as we've been focused on the work bolstered by a majority of our supporters. So we're doing fine. Thanks for asking, Robin.
The Attorney General said that under Greg's leadership, sums of money were wired overseas without receipts. Credit cards were used. He said not malicious management, but sloppy mismanagement. Your response to the report?
Well, we do respectfully disagree with some of the analysis and the conclusions. We feel confident that we were a wonderful organization growing very quickly. And to the point about Greg, he was working toward the mission at all times. And that is most important. I think CAI has been able to account for all the funds donated to the organization and expended by the organization. And that's where we feel confident, and a majority of our supporters do as well, as we move forward.
Well, I want to ask you about the supporters. And again, we have to, you know, the Attorney General did find mismanagement and said that Greg Mortensen had to pay money back. He'd already paid something like $500,000 back, so only has $500,000 to go, which is no small matter. But what are your supporters saying?
Well, our supporters see beyond, I think, the immediate rush to judgment, and they see the long-term benefits of educating girls, especially in the areas that we serve.
We're reading reports, Marilyn Hempstead, for instance, president of the American Association of University Women, a branch in La Crosse, Wisconsin. She organized a local campaign of your program, Pennies for Peace. This is helping school children raise pennies that add up to thousands of dollars across the country. And she says, while disappointed, no one she's talked to regrets giving money to CAI. So it's, you know, this is underscoring what you just said.
Yeah, that's wonderful to hear. And that's what's bolstered us the whole way through. And a majority of our issues were part of a rapid period of growth. And I think a lot of nonprofit organizations go through those kind of growing pains, so to speak. We just had a high-profile individual, unconventional. But unconventional people change the world, and I think Greg Mortensen did. There's certainly nothing criminal behind Central Asia Institute or Greg, and he always had a mind for an equitable share, and it just fell behind. He has a reputation for sometimes being a little late. So.
Well, and maybe head in the clouds, a lot of these things have been said.
Visionary.
Well, but, you know, is one of the things that you learned is that it's dangerous to have boards and organizations filled with friends of the founder, you know, people like you, you know, who are very closely associated with CAI and maybe didn't want to see some of these financial problems.
Well, I think that's where we, again, respectfully disagree with the classification or whatever you want to call it, because it's been about a small group of people making extraordinary impact, especially overseas. The relationships that Greg formed within the first decade of his heart song, we'll call it, when he went over and saw the need, especially in the high mountain communities where there were no schools. So I think I understand about a need for independence, and that certainly will be part of our moving forward.
Well, and then there's the other issue, the civil class action suit that people who've read the books have brought after Jon Krakauer and 60 Minutes did an expose asserting that a lot of the claims that Greg Mortensen makes about how this story started aren't true. Schools have been built. That, you know, that no one's questioning whether the charity has actually done the work it claimed to do in building schools and teaching kids. But his dramatic story of how he was inspired to do this after a failed climb, being kidnapped by the Taliban, being inspired and rescued by a village, what happens when that shoe falls?
Well, first, I love the first part of your point, which is the schools that have been built, the programs we support, because over the last year we've had an opportunity to really go in and verify a lot of the work that's been done. And there are over 180 schools and 30 women's vocational centers. And with the lawsuit, we think it's meritless and warrantless. And as from the beginning, Greg stands by his books.
Right after the story broke, he became very ill. I had heart issues.
Yeah.
And then this must be pretty devastating. How is he doing?
He's feeling really strong. With the heart surgery, it made all the difference. He's feeling much stronger, and with challenges come opportunities. That's how you have to look at it.
Does Greg plan to speak, maybe, you know, address some of the questions about some aspects of the story? You know?
I think he is. He's looking forward. Right now his work is out of the public eye, primarily due to the litigation.
What an incredible arc.
Mm-hmm.
We've had him on this program several times. We followed him to a local school and saw the response to his story and to the books. You say you disagree with some of the Attorney General's conclusions.
Respectfully disagree.
Respectfully. But, you know, when it comes to questions about the story itself, I mean, do you feel at all betrayed? Or do close friends of his feel, you know, why did you do this? Because even in its least embellished form, it's a great story.
Yeah, I can't really speak to that because I feel so grounded with the perspective that we hold here. We just got back from Pakistan a little while ago and planning for the year ahead. And I think it's perspective, Robin. The fact that we work with people who have to walk miles to get potable water, that literacy, the numbers are huge. And for me, I trust him. He's one of the most compassionate people I know. I think he's changed the world, and I think he needs support to do what he does best, and that's connecting people through their shared experiences rather than their differences.
Ann Beiersdorfer, acting director of the Central Asia Institute, the Bozeman, Montana-based charity started by Greg Mortensen, author of Three Cups of Tea. Ann, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Back in 1993, Anne Lamott, then a 35-year-old single mom, wrote a funny and unflinching memoir of her son Sam's first year. It was called Operating Instructions. You could think of her as sort of Benjamin Spock, but as a left-leaning, recovering alcoholic, born-again Christian in blonde dreadlocks in Marin County, California. Now, two decades later, Annie Lamott has written a book with Sam, who's now a father, which makes Annie Lamott, what, could it be a grandmother? One who's still trying to figure out the owner's manual. Here's a portion of a letter she writes her grandson, just months old, telling him that if you go through life thinking there's a day in second grade you missed when grown-ups came in and explained everything to kids, you'd be wrong. There is no explainer, and that's okay.
This lack of instruction manual is how most people develop compassion and how they figure out how to show up, care, help, and serve as the only way of filling up and being free. Otherwise, you grow up to be someone who needs to dominate and shame others so no one will know that you weren't there the day the instructions were passed out. I know exactly one other thing that I hope will be useful, that when electrical things stop working properly, 90% of the time you can fix them by unplugging the cord for 2 or 3 minutes. I'm sure there is a useful metaphor here.
Annie Lamott's new book is called Some Assembly Required, A Journal of My Son's First Son. She joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Annie, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
So let's get right to it. You say there's a useful metaphor there. I'm thinking maybe that idea of unplugging the cord is you. you know, cut the umbilical cord even to your son. I mean, this just triggered something in you when your very young son and his very young wife have a baby.
Well, it's kind of scary if you've had one plan that you thought was more or less the way things were going to bounce, and i.e. that your son would go to college, and which he was doing, and then graduate, and then get involved in a career that seemed to hold a lot of promise, and then meet someone, etc., and then a few years later have children. And instead, he was 19, and he announced that he and his girlfriend were having a baby. And all I could do was to hang my head and then to say, "Oh, Sam." And then, of course, call all my girlfriends in complete hysteria and say, "It's all over. It's hopeless. We're doomed. He'll drop out of school. We'll all end up at the rescue mission." And then he called later and said, "Oh, hi, hon."
Right, right. It sort of passed, as several storms do as you go through these, you know, the birth, the first few months. And when I think of you and when I talk about, you know, you unplugging, I'm thinking of Shirley MacLaine in that movie, what was it, where she's a grandmother and she's so concerned about the baby that she literally climbs next to the baby to, you know, listen to the baby breathing. That's sort of what I was picturing.
Yeah, it's terms of endearment. Yeah, and yeah. She's convinced, she's shouting that the baby is dead as she climbs into the crib, and the husband off screen is saying, "The baby's sleeping." And then you hear the baby begin to sob because the grandmother's woken him up.
That's what I was picturing, you know, of
yeah,
you.
Yeah, and the need to unplug and to believe that the baby may actually be sleeping, you know. For me, the whole book and the whole year was about trying to get my sticky mitts off the controls of the spaceship and to release Sam and Amy to the care of their own higher power, who it turned out was not me, and to keep remembering that it was their baby, it wasn't mine.
And shocking.
I couldn't believe it. I thought it was so rude. But also, I've heard over the years that if it's not your problem, you probably don't have the solution. And I discovered as a grandmother, and once again as a mother, that the very hardest thing is letting go without leaving claw marks on everything, you know, just trusting and surrendering. And so, you know, some days went better than others.
You're also speaking as not just a grandmother, but as a recovering alcoholic and someone who, you know, whose life has been turned around for a couple decades now by 12-step thinking, and also combined with your faith. I mean, it's hard for everybody, but sounds like it's harder for you, even someone who's practiced letting go for 20 years.
I get better and better and better, and I thought that I'd made real headway, and then my grandson Jax was born, and I think most grandparents just have the same sort of good ideas that I have, which is that you've been around for a while, whereas the kids don't even have fully formed neocortexes. So your good ideas should be taken into account. But you know what? They don't want to hear your good ideas. It's their kid. And the extent to which you try to inflict your goodness on them is the extent to which they're not going to let you see the baby. So you figure out, it's sort of Pavlovian. It's like when I control, manage, martyr myself, manipulate, they keep the baby away from me. If I let go and pretend to have equanimity, I get to see the baby. Which will it be? This book is so much about prying your clutched fingers off of other people's lives and really letting my son be on his own hero's journey. And not only that, but agreeing not to run along beside him on it with my clipboard and post-its, you know, and my good ideas, because they're going to do what they're going to do. And there may be really painful results for everybody, and still none of your business.
Well, as you write, you had gotten all excited about having a Valentine's Day for them, and then they show up fighting, and, you know, but you end that entry by saying, "Well, even if they were both in free fall, I am not their parachute. God is." Yuck, I hate that. You know,
oh, I hate that.
Well, where are you now in the story of Sam and Amy and Jax?
He's 2.5, and he is absolutely a magical being, but at the same time, he has very strong opinions sort of from nowhere. And I liked it about a month ago, but now, no noodles, no biscuit, and no apple. And but anyway, Sam and Amy split up almost a year ago.
What? They split up? I mean, part of the tension of this book of the first year is you are so petrified that Amy might move back to Chicago to be with her family and take Jax with her. And it's got to be so hard to just stand and be the Greek chorus. You know, there's nothing you can do. Even though your heart might be breaking for your child.
Well, my heart really wasn't breaking when they split up, just to be honest. I think there's nothing worse than growing up with tense married parents like I did, who were married for 27 years and really didn't want to be. It's really been a good thing, I think, for both of them. And they live nearby, and this has just been amazingly sweet and kind of, you know, life on life's terms.
Well, and talk a little bit about Sam. You interview him throughout the book, and at one point he says, I'm getting more resilient as a father about doing things I don't want to do. The self-centered person is still totally there, even though I'm a father figure. But then he goes on to say, you know, it's this deep connection, one that he had with his grandmother, that transcends death. It's like wireless internet versus one of those old coiled-up phone cords. Sam sounds pretty amazing.
Sam is so trippy, but he's always had a really deep spiritual aspect. Now he's, well, I'm just looking at the back cover. I just want to read one sentence, if that's okay.
Sure.
It says, my wild son, who like most boys, smashed and bashed his way through childhood with branches and bats and wooden swords, who shut down and pulled so far away as a teenager that sometimes I could not find him, now taking care of his own newborn, a miniature who is both unique and reflexive. You know, and watching him change poopy diapers and grow into that and step into that is humbling.
Annie Lamott, author of the grandparenting memoir, Some Assembly Required, a Journal of My Son's First Son. Annie, so great to talk to you.
You too. I really appreciate it.